A little bit on my background. I have worked with GLBT populations, populations in India, and sex workers in India. I've served in various roles as researcher, as a volunteer at the STD clinics. Presently, I work around issues of homelessness and adherence to HIV meds. And so, you know, this is one of the one of my earlier projects, and we are still kind of, you know, we're still working with the data, and we're still kind of trying to wrap our heads around what this means. So, as you can see, the name of the title, we are really going to talk about, really look at the different like narratives of around violence that are experienced by gay, bisexual, and transgender women in India. So I don't have any particular declarations of interest. So, you know, it's sufficient to say that the presence of violence anywhere in itself should raise concern and warrant action. But for gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals, these are of particular significance. In India, we see that these populations are disproportionately affected by the HIV epidemic, and they experience high rates of stigma, violence, and negative mental health outcomes. And it's been suggested that the experience of violence interacts in a way with the ongoing HIV epidemic to produce these things which are called synergistic epidemics or syndemics, like accelerated epidemics. So, you know, so this really kind of requires for us to really understand what's going on with the violence piece if we ever need to, if you think we can make any progress with trying to curb the HIV transmission. So for this particular paper, we are trying to look at the risk environment model as proposed by Rhodes and colleagues. So this is a change from the earlier more individualized concept of risk to a more structural approach, which says that, you know, individuals exist in different intersecting environments, like that of the physical, social, economic, and policy environments, and these environments produce certain conditions which lead to high risk in individuals for certain behaviors, for certain experience. And we're going to use this model to look at our narratives of violence that emerge from our data, from our participants. So for this particular study, we partnered with Anandam, which is a community-based organization serving gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, Koti, and Hijra populations in Kolkata in India. As many of you may know, Koti is a particular term. It's an indigenous cultural term that referred to MSM, or people who usually adopt a more feminine affect and play the more passive role in sexual encounters. And Hijra is a similar indigenous term which has a long history, long social, cultural, religious history, and it refers very loosely to what we call transgender women in the West. So this particular organization is a subsidiary of the DMSC or the Shonagachi Project, which is a sex workers collective in India and which has been hailed as one of the model structural interventions for HIV by the WHO. So this is an organization that has grown out of that umbrella, and that might be something to keep in mind when we're discussing the results. So for this study, we used convenient snowball sampling. It's like the way to kind of, you know, get at people who are usually not available. We know, you know, the pitfalls of that, but, you know, it's convenient, and it's something that, you know, we often employ with similar populations. And we managed to get 30 interviews. The questions we asked, questions about, like, among other things, questions about experience of violence, discrimination, and stigma. Most of the interviews were done either in Bengali, and a few were in Hindi. The interviews were audio recorded, transcribed, and then translated to English by me. And for analysis, and also during the collection of the data, we used elements of constructivist grounded theory, which is basically we use this constant comparative method to look at themes. We engage in some simultaneous data collection and analysis, and when we reach theoretical saturation, it's the stage where no new ideas, no new themes emerge. That's the time when we kind of stop sampling for more. So, you know, these are, you know, that's, we didn't use like a more classical way of talking about grounded theory. We used kind of elements from that, and we can talk about that later if anyone's interested. So the first and the second author we independently coded, and then looked for reliability among the codes, and rigor was we tried to achieve some rigor through maintaining extensive research journals, memorizing, comparing codes as they evolved, and towards the end we had a a couple of focus groups to check in with members to see whether we were telling their stories in the way that they wanted them to be told. So a quick view on the participants' characteristics. We had amongst our participants 18 who identified as male, 5 as transgender women or transgender female, and 7 as belonging to the Hijra community. 10 identified as being gay, 12 identified as being MSM or that they have exclusive sexual relationships with male identified partners, and 8 identified having relationships with both male and female identified partners. And about 50% of our participants reported engaging in sex work or transactional sex at some point in their lives. So looking at the results, one of the most obvious things was that certain physical environments like parks, which are cruising areas or public sex environments, were associated with violent interactions. And particularly, these were the places where participants most publicly engaged in a stigmatized behavior, and hence they felt that they were more susceptible to kind of detection and violent reactions from people around. Parks, particularly cruising sites, can be frequently unsafe sites, and this example it's exemplified very well by this quote, which says, one of the participants describes his experience one night, like, this guy took me to this dark corner and I was afraid. He wanted to do very intense stuff. I did not want that, but it was in the dark and he was a big guy. I got frightened and I agreed. He also slapped me and punched me. So we see how the participant's ability to negotiate safe sex and his personal safety was undermined by the threat of violence in the situation. And when we are thinking of HIV prevention, these are the things we probably need to address more directly over and above condom knowledge and things like that. As the previous presentation pointed out, like help-seeking behavior, and in situations like this, the first first line of defense should be law enforcement people and like the police. But however, given the policy situation, which we'll come to, given the laws that criminalize same-sex activity, police are seen more as a threat and as perpetrators of violence themselves, rather than people whom we can kind of turn to for protection. So, as this person says, like, police is always there, but I'm too afraid to go into that corner of the lake because police is there. I've heard stories where they beat you with their baton or may even lock you up. So, this is one strain of thought. And contrary to this, and this we think was pretty interesting, that some participants actually reported feeling safe in parks, given that their strength in numbers. So as this person says, the park is okay. I do not go there alone. My friends are there always. I can see if anyone is coming when we are talking to someone. If we see someone nice, we all try to go and talk. But it's okay, you know, my friends will look after me if anyone tries to do anything. We have some signals and shout them out if we see the police coming or some goons coming. I know my friends will come and help me. And so we see how being in a group and looking out for each other was a protective factor against violence in public sex environments. And these are maybe the things we want to keep in mind when we are thinking of interventions or approaches to kind of promote safety. So the other source of violence, as identified by most of our participants, was the social environment that they inhabit, mostly in the form of families, groups, localities, neighborhoods, and peers. Particularly for our participants, family could be a site of great support or violence, and especially around issues such as disclosure of sexual activities, disclosure of sexual preference, that can precipitate really violent interactions, as exemplified by this quote where this person describes the days leading up to and unwitting disclosure about his sexual activities to his parents. He says, "I was without food for days. My mother stopped talking to me. I was so hurt. I expected my father to be like that, but my mother too? I feel sad all the time. My mother says she cannot live with this knowledge." And we can detect the trains of the strains of intense trauma in this narrative. And but you know, the social environment doesn't stop to the family. Like, you know, looking at the next immediate group, either like the neighborhood or the locality, where many people, when they come to know about same-sex activity or people of an individual who claims to have such preferences, they kind of immediately assume the role of the moral police, and in that self-righteous way, they kind of some of those interactions can lead to a lot of violence. As this person says, that when the people in my locality, the people in my locality who came to know about me, would not look at me anymore. The young boys would call me names. I began avoiding the main road. I do not like any of that. If I had money, I would have moved to a new flat. That's like change address. So we see that, you know, we see the helplessness the person feels in dealing with such prejudice and how it's negatively impacting his sense of well-being. And lastly, and perhaps in certain ways, very importantly for both the other issues, is we see that these interactions are taking place in the overarching policy environment, where laws which criminalize same-sex activity, they perpetuate stigma and discrimination, and they act as barriers for seeking police assistance for violent victimization. As this person says, like, you know, I cannot go to the police, really, because, you know, he says, what will the police do? They will say, you do all this and now you want us to protect you? Why did you not think when you wanted to have sex in the park? We have better things to do. And in this context, it's probably very important to refer to the law that's called IPC 377. It's the archaic colonial law, which the anti-sodomy law, basically, which still exists in the Indian Penal Code, which criminalizes all same-sex behavior. And a few years back, a lower court had actually struck it down in response to a public interest litigation, declaring it to be unconstitutional. And last December, the Supreme Court effectively reinstated this law and said that, you know, this is not for the courts to decide, and the legislature will decide, the elected representatives will decide whether such law stays or not. So this is like a very important quote, which kind of reflects the, you know, the fleeting moment of elation that occurred around this, you know, the verdict from the lower court. When the court cancelled 377, we were so happy. We thought, now we can be safe. People will not lock us up. Police will not lock us up. We can say to them, we are citizens, protect us. So it directly goes back to this idea that, you know, how this law effectively curtails, disenfranchises individuals as rightful citizens of the state. And also it must be said that, you know, this law has very rarely been actually used to convict, to either charge or convict. However, the presence of this law serves as a symbolic source of violence. The threat posed by this law is perhaps, you know, more anxiety provoking than any actual legal actions taken by that takes place with the help of this law. As this person says, it doesn't matter if they do not arrest you. You are too afraid because you know that such laws exist. They can threaten to give you a case, that is, to book you for some offense. What will my parents think if they hear that I have been questioned by the police? It's better to give them some money and let it be. I do not have connections. Who will help me out? Police can do anything. I'm too worried about my status to end up in a police station. And there we see, like, you know, how the social stigma kind of interacts or is kind of enabled by this overarching environment of policies which stigmatize certain behaviors. And so in conclusion, we say, basically, like, you know, conceptually, we can link these different narratives, to different environments, like, you know, the ones that we discussed, the physical environment, which is kind of, you know, which interacts with the policy environment, which interacts with the social environment people live in. And these all environments, actually, they don't exist in these wonderful little silos, but they interact with each other and produce amplified negative effects or harm. And so we can say that definitely any intervention for violence and for HIV should any interventions for HIV should necessarily address violence, and any such interventions should necessarily be multi-level, or at least attempt to be multi-level, trying to address some of these issues. Even if they are individual-based individualized approaches, definitely, you know, there should be sections where we think about, you know, okay, how to interact with the police, how to interact with family members, and probably including these groups, recognizing these people as stakeholders in the problem, and including them in interventions. So for next steps for this particular study, we are planning to back it up, to create a survey out of these results, out of these qualitative results, and probably, test out this risk environment model and, test out correlations, other correlations like the ones that the previous presentation very rightly signaled at. And, those will be the first steps if we really want to do anything about violence or HIV in a place like India. So acknowledgements, Anandam and DMSC, these are the organizations I've been a part of for a long, long time. I'm really happy that they have allowed me to kind of, use their resources. And that's it. Thank you.